Good morning, everyone, and it's a real pleasure to be here. As Anthony said, I spoke 2 years ago at the CFA conference in Melbourne, and it's great to be able to speak here again in Sydney. I also want to begin by congratulating the CFA, really, for the topic that they've chosen for this year's conference. As you can see here, it's going back to fundamentals. In a world in which the focus is too often on the short term, I think this conference theme serves a very timely reminder that ultimately it's fundamentals that matter. In the area of finance, the CFA Institute's been playing a leading role in reinforcing the fundamentals of trust and of fiduciary duty. Unfortunately, over recent years, we've seen too many examples around the world where not enough attention was paid to these fundamentals, and as a result, the reputation of the financial sector has been very badly tarnished. The work of the CFA in promoting the highest standards of ethics and in professional excellence is helping to return the focus to these fundamentals of finance. This is extraordinarily important work, and I wish you all success in pursuing it. This morning, though, I want to talk about a different set of fundamentals, and that's the fundamentals of the Australian economy. My central message is that these fundamentals are strong, and they do provide us with the basis to be optimistic about the future. At the same time, though, none of us has a crystal ball, so we can't be sure exactly what that future holds for us. I think what we can be sure of is that we'll be best placed to take advantage of our fundamentals if our economy is flexible and it's able to adapt to the changing world in which we find ourselves. Hence the title of my remarks this morning, Fundamentals and Flexibility. I think it's probably useful to start with some context, and this is usefully provided by this first chart, which shows various measures of how Australia's output and income have grown over the past couple of decades. The green line at the bottom here shows output per hour worked. It's the conventional measure of labour productivity. The orange line, the middle line, shows real income per hour worked. In most countries, real output and real income track one another quite closely, and indeed that was the case in Australia during the 1990s. But over the 2000s, as you can see, real income increased much more quickly than real output, and that's a result of the increase in the terms of trade. We became better off as a nation because the prices of the goods and services that we sold overseas were increasing much more quickly than the prices of goods that we were buying from the rest of the world. And finally, the blue line shows real income not per hour worked, but per person in Australia. And I think this is the best measure of how average living standards have progressed through time. It takes into account the lift in productivity, the changes in the terms of trade, and importantly, changes in the share of the population that's in paid employment. And as you can see, it's the strongest of the three lines here. And this reflects the fact that over the past two decades, there's been a substantial increase in the share of the population in paid employment. Indeed, between 1993 and 2008, this share rose by 7 percentage points to over 50%. As I think you can see in this second chart, this increase in the employment to population ratios is accounted for by a decline in the unemployment rate, a rise in the participation rate, and a decline of in the share of children in the population that's shown in the effect of that shown in the top part of that graph. Now, taking these two decades or so as a whole, Australians have enjoyed very strong growth in our living standards. Real income per capita is currently 60% higher than it was in the early 1990s, and it's grown at an average rate of around 2% per year over this very long period. In the 1990s, we benefited from strong productivity growth. In the 2000s, we benefited from the lift in the terms of trade. And across both of these decades, we benefited from increasing labour force participation and favourable demographics. As you can see, the story over the last couple of years is a less positive one. While productivity growth has picked up a bit, the terms of trade have declined, and the share of the population in paid employment has also declined. And as a result, there's been very little growth in real per capita income in Australia since 2008. That's quite different, as you can see, from the very strong earlier upward trend. And I suspect it's this change that lies at the heart of some of the recent soul-searching about the future of the Australian economy. This soul-searching is evident in an increasing number of people asking, what comes next? What comes after the resources boom? Where will future growth in our living standards come from? Where will the jobs of the future be? These, of course, are all excellent questions. They help focus our minds on the challenges ahead, and they can promote better public policy. But we do need to be careful that the uncertainty that we feel about the future, and that is sometimes the undercurrent to these questions, does not mutate into chronic pessimism. For if that were to happen, then many of the opportunities that we really do have are likely to go missing. Looking to the future, I think it's unlikely that growth in our living standards will again come from a sustained lift in the terms of trade, which, as you can see in this chart, remain high in a historical context despite the falls over the last couple of years. Of course, we can't dismiss the possibility that we'll be lucky again, but it would surely be unwise for us to rely on ever-rising export prices as the basis for improvement in future living standards. Similarly, with the population ageing, it seems unlikely that we'll see a repeat of the large increase in the share of the population in paid employment. So this leaves improving our productivity as the only alternative. And this is where our fundamentals matter. I've spoken about some of these fundamentals on other occasions, but it's worth highlighting some of them again today. And there are five in particular that I'd like to draw your attention to. The first is Australia's strong institutional framework, including the rule of law, the respect for property rights, a well-functioning public administration, and a well-established regulatory system. We can sometimes take these things for granted, but really together they form the bedrock upon which our high-income economy is built. The second strong fundamental is our people. Our education system ranks reasonably highly by global standards. Australians have a can-do mentality, and they have a demonstrated capability to adjust to a changing world. We adopt new technologies relatively quickly, and many of us are prepared to take a risk. We've successfully drawn people from all around the world to our shores, with almost 40% of our population having been born overseas or having at least one parent who was born overseas. The third fundamental is our tremendous base of mineral resources. Australia is fortunate to have some of the biggest and the best quality resource deposits on the planet. While the resource sector goes through large cycles, our resources continue to be in strong demand from the rest of the world. The export receipts from these resources effectively pay for many of the imports that we buy. Over recent times, export receipts from resources have been equivalent to around half of Australia's annual import bill. The fourth fundamental is our agricultural assets. As average incomes in Asia grow, so too does the demand for protein. Higher incomes also mean that there's a greater preparedness and an ability to pay a premium price for high-quality, clean food. And with our large tracts of agricultural land and the expertise built up over many decades of using that land, Australia has obvious advantages here. And the fifth fundamental that I want to highlight is our links with Asia and our expertise in delivering high-quality services. Over recent years, the focus has understandably been very much on our relationship with China, and that focus undoubtedly will continue. But we shouldn't forget that there are significant opportunities elsewhere, including in Indonesia and in India with their very large populations. Many of these opportunities lie in the services part of the economy, including in tourism, finance, educational, and in professional services. So together, this combination of fundamentals should provide us with confidence that we can continue to experience advances in our living standards. It's a combination of fundamentals that very few other countries enjoy. Now, in an ideal world, we might be able to take these fundamentals and map them into a clear path for the future. We might be able to say that these particular industries will thrive and these ones won't, that this is where the jobs of the future will come from, that this is where we'll find the success stories. Unfortunately, the world in which we live is not so simple. It turns out that it's full of surprises and it's difficult to predict. And at least for me, looking back over the last few decades, two factors stand out as the main sources of this unpredictability. These are advances in technology and shifts in patterns in the global economy. The advances in technology are reshaping in unexpected ways the jobs that we do. If we were to go back to 1995, or perhaps even just to 2005, I suspect that there are very few of us who could have imagined many of the new occupations that have now emerged. There are the big data architects, the cloud computing experts, the social media strategists, the mobile app developers, the information security technicians, the green retrofit architects, the genetic counsellors. The list here goes on. Each of these new occupations is possible only because of advances in technology. More broadly, the huge growth in employment in the service sector has taken many people by surprise. Again, I suspect that if in the early 1990s we'd known that over the next 25 years there would be a net loss of 100,000 jobs in the manufacturing sector in Australia, there would have been a sense of despair about the future. The despair would probably have been compounded if we'd also known that there'd be no growth in jobs in the utility sector and in the wholesale trade sector over the next quarter of a century. Yet over this period, we've enjoyed a strong rise in our living standards. The unemployment rate has come down substantially, and we've generated around 4 million new jobs across the economy. As you can see in this chart, they're mostly in the services sector. As I said, the other big source of unpredictability has been shifts in the global economy. Now, you might recall that around the time of the Sydney Olympics, there was much gnashing of teeth by those who saw Australia as an old economy, just selling resources to the rest of the world at ever-declining prices. We were seen by many to be locked out of the new economy and destined for decline. At the time, few people saw the great opportunities that would come our way as a result of the emergence of China as a major force in the global economy. One example of this difficulty of predicting change that I'm fond of quoting comes from the conferences that the RBA organises every decade or so to take a stock take of how our own economy has evolved and the opportunities that lie ahead. In the volume published after the conference in the year 2000, the words China and Chinese do not appear a single time. Yet there were nearly 100 references to the United States. In contrast, a decade later, in the volume published in 2011, there were nearly 300 references to China, and the number of references to the US was similar to that it was 10 years ago. A related example of the changes that are taking place can be seen in the changing destination of Australia's exports. The very strong growth in the Japanese economy for some decades after World War II saw Japan become the major destination of our exports, as you can see in this chart. Given this, if in the 1970s we'd known what lay ahead for the Japanese economy, we might have been concerned for our own future. But as Japan slowed, exports to other parts of East Asia took off, as you can see. And then over recent years, we've seen this a third phase with very strong growth of exports to China. None of these big shifts in our global trade patterns were widely predicted. Now, the point of these various examples is that while we might wish for certainty about the future, it's simply not possible to have such certainty. Technological progress is unpredictable, and when it occurs, it opens up possibilities that we have even trouble imagining today. The patterns in the global economy will no doubt continue to evolve, and we can hazard a guess at what this evolution might look like. As I said earlier, the future does have a way of surprising us. So the question is, how can we best take advantage of our strong fundamentals in this world that is difficult to predict? I think a large part of the answer lies in ensuring that the economy has a high degree of flexibility, that it's adaptable and nimble, and that it can respond quickly to changes in relative prices and seize new opportunities brought about by advances in technology and changes in the global economy. There's no single policy lever, though, called flexibility or adaptability. The degree of flexibility of the economy is the result of accumulation of numerous decisions and policies across many, many areas. In the area directly related to the central bank, the flexibility of the exchange rate is obviously a key element. For more than three decades now, our floating exchange rate has arguably been the single most stabilising influence on our own economy. It's helped us deal with some very large global shocks, and it continues to do so. Particularly, that appreciation over the past couple of years is playing an important role in helping the economy adjust to the wind down in the boom in mining investment. Another critical area to flexibility is the financial sector, as it provides the resources that businesses need to expand as new opportunities come along. While Australia has been very well served by its financial institutions and markets over many years, we need to make sure that the regulatory environment remains conducive to new forms of finance that can help fund innovation and the development of new ideas. The recent work by the Australian Government to facilitate crowdsourced equity funding, I think, is an important step in this direction. Here, the challenge is to get the balance right between funding innovation and protecting investors. Most of the other areas, though, that affect the flexibility of the economy lie beyond the world of central banks and beyond the world of finance. And I just want to briefly mention four of these. The first is the competitive environment in which firms operate. When competition is robust and entry to markets is easy, businesses have a stronger incentive to find better ways of doing things. They also have a stronger incentive to move quickly, lest a competitor sees an opportunity before they do. I think it's probably fair to say that few businesses really like competition, but often it's competition that drives them to do better and to respond to new opportunities. Competition benefits us all of us as consumers, bringing new and lower cost goods and services to the marketplace. So we need a regulatory environment that's conducive to new entry, including by those who are able to harness new technologies to reinvent how things are done. The second area is the nature of the incentives to innovate and to start new businesses. These incentives are affected by the tax system and the regulatory and legal systems. They're affected by the general community attitude to risk-taking. We'll be better placed to take advantage of our strong fundamentals if our culture is one that accepts risk and appropriately rewards risk-taking. A third area is the operation of the labour market. From a macro view, Australia's labour market arrangements have worked quite well over recent times. During the global downturn, flexibility in hours helped limit the rise in unemployment. Then during the resources boom, the very large increases in wages were mainly confined to areas where skills were in short supply, and they did not spread across the economy as a whole. And more recently, as you can see in this next graph, the slowing in aggregate wage growth has helped employment to grow reasonably strongly over the past year, despite below average growth in the overall economy. So from a cyclical perspective, the labour market has proved to be quite flexible and things have worked out reasonably well. I think a more open question, though, is the degree of flexibility in dealing with structural change. Again, we are more likely to be able to capitalise on our strong fundamentals if our system of workplace relations helps businesses and their employees respond quickly and effectively to new opportunities. This is especially so when business models are changing and when the preferred working patterns of Australians are changing. As the Productivity Commission's recent draft report on Australia's framework for industrial relations concludes, it should be possible to simplify and improve the responsiveness of our current system while at the same time addressing the sometimes unequal bargaining power in the labour market. And the fourth area and the final area I want to note is the nature of the education system. No matter what the future holds for us, it seems probable that continual improvement in our human capital will hold us in good stead. But given the unpredictability of the world in which we live, we need to find the right balance between the development of specific technical and professional skills and the general cognitive skills that are central to both flexibility and adaptability. So in each of these four areas, competition policy, the reward for innovation, the industrial relations system and the education system, the choices that we make are critical to the flexibility of our economy. I want to conclude by noting that I've not mentioned interest rates once today. It's not because they're not important. The RBA's monetary policy plays a key role in dealing with cyclical swings in the economy. We aim to keep inflation low and stable so that people can go about their business without having to worry about large movements in the general price level. And our actions help promote stability in Australia's overall economy and its financial system. These are obviously all important contributions. But ultimately, the rate at which our living standards improve is unlikely to be driven by the actions of the central bank. Indeed, the improvement in our living standards rests on our ability to improve our fundamentals and to enhance the flexibility of our economy so that it can take full advantage of the opportunities that are out there in this ever-changing world. I wish you all success today in your own deliberations about fundamentals, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Phil. Everybody has question cards on their table. There are people roaming around. If you want to write down a question, by all means, send it up to me. Also, we have microphones, if anybody prefer just to do a microphone. Guys, if you get somebody for a question, please raise your hands with the microphone. And here we go. Phil, this one's to you. How do you expect the gap between growth in income versus growth in output to restore itself in your first chart? Do the lines converge, or do we have an extended period where incomes lag output?
The main reason that growth in incomes is lagging growth in output is the decline in the terms of trade. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to predict how they're going to move in the future. They've already fallen a long way, as that chart showed, but they're still high by historical standards. And I think this is one of the big questions for us: what does the long-term future of commodity prices look like relative to the price of manufactured goods, which is what we essentially import? I personally think it unlikely that we go back to the level of the terms of trade we saw in the average to the 1990s. The world demand for commodities has increased a lot, and we've moved up the global supply curve, and so we're moving into slightly more expensive ore bodies around the world. So the costs of production, the marginal cost of production, is higher, and I think that means that the commodity prices on average are going to be higher relative to manufactured goods than they were in the 1990s. So I expect there'll still be a wedge between those two lines. The more critical issue is how do we make both lines grow strongly? And I think they're some of the issues that I tried to touch on.
And just to be clear on that, I guess, Phil, that's when you start talking about things outside of commodities. It's when you start talking about other exports and other high-value added.
Well, it's not just exports, it's the way we do internal non-traded goods and services as well to become more efficient, and more productive as a nation in producing the whole range of goods and services that we do.
The, could you comment on the adjustment of the economy as a result of the fall in the Australian dollar? How far has the economic adjustment come, and how far is there to go?
Well, it's an extraordinarily large adjustment that we're going through. In other talks, I've tried to put in context the size of this adjustment, and I think without exaggeration, we've seen the biggest commodities boom since the gold rush in the 1850s. Mining investment nearly went to 8% of GDP. In previous mining booms in Australia in the 20th century, it got to 3 or 4%. So it's an extraordinarily large rise in mining investment. The terms of trade got to the highest level in 150 years. We digested that huge boom without the economy overheating, and that was largely because the exchange rate went up. We had higher than average interest rates, and the household sector was relatively restrained in its own behaviour. But now mining investment's falling back, the terms of trade are falling back, and some of those adjustments that stopped the economy overheating are now unwinding, and an important part of that is the lower exchange rate. And you can clearly see this now in our trade figures. There's been very strong growth in exports of services, and imports of services have slowed down as fewer Australians are travelling overseas. So we can see, particularly in tourism, but also in a range of services, that lower exchange rate is working to help rebalance the economy. The critical issue that we still face is fairly low levels of business investment outside the resources sector. And I've talked on previous occasions about why that is, why that's low. But that's the thing we really need to see pick up for this transition to work out relatively seamlessly.
Business investment, okay. So we talked about currency. Another question here is, you haven't mentioned fiscal policy as a fundamental strength and or source of flexibility in our economy. I guess, what would you like to see from fiscal policy?
What would I like to see from fiscal policy? I think that the main issue we have here is making sure that over the medium term our fiscal accounts are in good order. You've seen in other countries where they got themselves into trouble, where effectively the population was offered something by the political class that ultimately could not be delivered, a whole range of goods and services without the taxing base to, or the willingness to tax people to pay for those goods and services. Fortunately, Australia didn't have that problem. And we've got to make sure that that remains the case. So I think that's the number one fiscal issue, to make sure that the medium-term fiscal accounts are sustainable. And then in the short term, I think moderate fiscal consolidation along this medium-term path makes sense.
We have one question from the floor. Thank you.
Good morning. Nicole Chettle from the ABC. There are reports today about predicted declines in house prices of up to, or property prices of 7.5%, and the broader impact that might have in terms of the economy. What's your view? Are you concerned?
Well, it looks like that the rate of price growth in Sydney has slowed down a little bit. And in a way, that's not surprising, because the supply of new housing is rising, and you see this right across the country, where the supply of housing increases, the rate of price growth eventually responds. And it's too early to be definitive, but I think we're on the cusp of seeing the supply response finally kick in, moderating price growth. I hope that's the case, because, as I've said a number of times over the past year, the risk of developments in the housing market derailing the economy has increased a little bit. The risk in the housing sector is higher than it was a few years back. I think the measures that APRA have taken here have been sensible. They appear to be having a moderate effect. You've seen a tightening of lending standards through the banking sector, a repricing of loans, banks requiring larger deposits. And I think those things are gradually working their way through the system, but People do need to be careful here, because house prices aren't going to continue to rise much more quickly than income. Debt levels can't keep rising faster than income. So people need to be careful, but the supply response does seem to be kicking in. And that, if that's what's happening, that's good news.
I suppose it's interesting. I mean, you took us through the falls in the terms of trade. We're talking about a potential 7.5% fall in, say, residential property. The economy could probably absorb that.
Well, I don't want to endorse that particular number. I mean, house prices in Sydney, as opposed to apartment, but house prices in Sydney have risen by more than 20% over the past year, and that prices are still rising. So I think that ideally we would now go through a period of quite modest house price growth. I think that would de-risk household balance sheets a little, and it would probably be good for the economy. So not my central scenario, the one that was the subject of the newspaper stories this morning.
Okay, thank you. You seem to suggest that interest rates aren't going to play an important role in improving living standards. Does that mean RBA thinks there is little interest rates can do to boost the economy?
I think interest rates are probably less effective than they used to be. In earlier decades, what we found was when interest rates were lowered, it didn't take that much for consumers to respond to borrow, either for housing or more fundamentally for household consumption. You know, house prices would rise and people would quickly go to the bank when interest rates were lower to extract some of the equity to buy a new car or to go on a holiday or to increase their spending. I think those days are over, or at least they're over for quite a while. So the household sector are really using the lower interest rates not to increase their consumption, but to try to pay back their debt a bit more quickly. And so it's quite a different dynamic than the one that we used to be in. It doesn't mean that monetary policy is not effective. I think we're clearly seeing the effectiveness of that in the residential construction market, which is having flow-through effects through to consumption. And obviously there are links between the exchange rate and interest rates as well. So interest rates are still working. I don't think they're quite as effective as it used to be. But as you prefaced in your question, the interest rates are not the source of long-term growth in living standards. Ideally, what we want is a world in which interest rates rise, because higher interest rates mean that the underlying return on capital in the economy is higher. If underlying return on capital is higher, there's more investment, there's more growth. So the low interest rates are symptomatic globally of a lack of investment opportunities and a lack of growth. And a return to something more normal, I think, would serve us all well in time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's good to remember. Sorry, did you have another question at the back?
Yes, I do. The US Central Bank says...
Can you hold the microphone closer, please?
The US Central Bank says it's taking a cautious approach in its deliberations over interest rates, but there's talk that they will rise this year. How closely are you watching that, and what impact would that have here?
We're obviously watching that very carefully. When they finally do raise interest rates, I think we should welcome that, because it would be a sign that the US economy, or the Federal Reserve thinks the US economy has enough underlying growth momentum to start the process of normalisation. If that turns out to be the case, I think that's basically good for the world, because a stronger US economy helps the rest of the world as well. I think for us, when that happens, I would expect to see some adjustment in exchange rates, just as we've seen in the last couple of weeks, some adjustment the other way as the timing of the market's expected timing of the adjustment being pushed out. I think the other thing that we'll need to watch very carefully around the world really is capital flows. As the US eventually raises rates, some of the capital that's flown to the emerging market economies will start, to some extent this has already happened, but will start flowing back to the United States. And it's possible that will create some stresses in capital markets. So that's something that we'll need to watch carefully. But think the main point is that we should all hope that the US Federal Reserve feels like it's in a position before too long to raise interest, start the gradual process of raising interest rates there, because that will be a sign that there is enough underlying growth momentum in the United States to start the normalisation process, which I think is in all our interest.
Let me just keep going, but there's another question here, I guess. How do you maintain policy flexibility when the rest of the world is in a desynchronous state?
Well, we feel like we've still got quite a lot of flexibility. Our exchange rate moves a lot. It wasn't that long ago that one Australian dollar would almost buy you $1.10. Mm-hmm. And I think earlier last week it was buying you 69 cents. So the exchange rate moves a lot, and that, as I said in my remarks, is the core stabilising influence in our economy. We still have flexibility on interest rates. We're one of the few advanced economies that has not had to put our interest rates at zero, which I think is a good thing. So we still have flexibility there. And because of our long history of fiscal prudence, we still have flexibility on fiscal policy if we really were to need that. So I think the Australian economy is proven to be remarkably flexible.
So
from a macroeconomic point of view, from a macro management point of view, I think that the more pressing issue is how flexible we are at the micro level.
Mm-hmm. So I'll maybe come back to the micro, but just for you on that idea, as you said, currency has been a great release valve for us. You spoke about the importance of China, and we've also seen China trying to free up its capital market. What do you think about the exchange rate in China, and how quickly should they actually move to a more flexible system on their exchange rate?
Well, this is a huge challenge for them, and I'm not going to give them gratuitous advice. it's been difficult for, I mean, every country finds this difficult. We found this difficult. It took us two decades, and we tried almost every conceivable exchange rate regime. We had a peg against the pound, a US dollar, peg against a trade weighted basket, a flexible link against a trade weighted basket, and then a floating currency. So we tried everything. And the Chinese are going through a similar process. They were effectively linked to the US dollar. They didn't like that as the US dollar rose, and then they tried to move to gradually to a more flexible system. Every country finds this difficult, and the Chinese are finding it difficult as well. It's very important ultimately for them, and that they say very publicly that they want a market determined exchange rate, and the process of getting there, as we found out and as many others found out, could be tricky.
Mm-hmm. So maybe coming back to the micro again, does Australia need to have a structural debasing of our total per unit wage costs? If so, how will this happen?
You're asking whether the level of wages are too high.
Yes.
I don't think that's our fundamental problem. I mean, we want to be a high wage, high productivity economy. The solution, or our salvation, shouldn't be in just driving wages down to be competitive in kind of mass-produced goods. It should be having high wages built on high human capital, good technology, being competitive in global markets. And that's where the things that I've talked about are all kind of key. Over the last couple of years, wage growth has been very low. Productivity, it's basically matched productivity. So I think for 3 or 4 years now, there's been no growth in unit labour costs in Australia, and that's actually helping with the short-run dynamics of the economy. But as I said in my remarks, that's part of the useful adjustment we're going through. But just driving wages down to compete isn't our solution. It isn't the solution here. It's focusing on these structural things.
Okay, we've got a few minutes left just for a few more questions, Joel. This is a long one. With the release of the IMF's revised downward projections of global growth, the Asian Infrastructure Bank's lower forecast for China GDP, and downward revisions, I suppose, around the world, including talk of a recession in Australia. Now, what is the likelihood that we are heading into a recession, in your view?
I mean, I think that that's a very difficult question. I think it's the probability of a recession is low, but there is a probability that at some point we will have a downturn. I mean, the idea that the Australian economy can just keep growing without having periods of short periods of contraction, I think, is a mistake. What we should be hoping for is that when those periods inevitably happen, that they're short-lived and that the economy adjusts quickly to deal with it. And as we said in our previous conversation, I think we do have those key elements of flexibility with interest rates, with the exchange rate, and ultimately with fiscal policy if that's needed. So this fascination about will we or won't we have a recession at some point in time, I personally think that's slightly misplaced. And the issue is really, when those periods happen, how do we best deal with them? And flexibility, again, is the key.
Mm-hmm. Live the cycle.
Yeah, there will be a cycle. I mean, we've had, as that graph, those graphs that I showed, we've had a remarkable 25 years. Let's hope something like that continues, but we can't rule out the possibility, again, of having a period where the economy contracts. It's not our central case. We think the economy is on a gradually improving track, and that the unemployment rate has stabilised, mm-hmm. that growth has been 2 to 2.5% for a while, but will gradually pick up. So that's our central base case.
Okay. We have one question from the floor.
You talked earlier about the risk of talking ourselves into too much pessimism, and there's been quite a difference for a while between business confidence and consumer confidence. Just wondering how you see that playing out. What catalyst is there for the consumer to cheer up, or otherwise do you think there's a risk that business gives up and business confidence falls?
And it's quite interesting because many people say business and consumer confidence is kind of incredibly weak, and it's just not correct. I mean, consumer confidence at the moment is around average, and some parts of the consumer sentiment survey are actually above average. And the latest business surveys show at least current business conditions to be a little above average as well. Businesses are clearly happy to hire workers at the moment. Employment's grown by almost 2% over the past year. And as I said, in the business surveys, they're reporting that current conditions are okay. So the issue is, at what point does that improvement translate into higher capital spending plans? And that's something that no one really can give a definitive answer to. Businesses are happy to hire workers, the cost of debt is low, consumers are spending at a reasonable rate. At some point, those factors, I think, will trip over to increase spending by businesses on capital. At what point are we still waiting for it?
Look, Phil, there's probably just one more. It was an interesting one, you know, should we be using state-based stamp duties as a way of tempering property markets in the hot markets?
I'm not quite sure how one would do that. You'd temporary raising and lowering stamp duties. I'm not going to kind of encourage the state governments to do that.
Very well answered.
I think that, you know, the main issue to deal with the property market, as I said in answer to a question earlier on, is supply. You know, where the supply has come into the market, prices growth has been less, and you clearly see this in the apartment markets in both Sydney and Melbourne, where apartment prices have grown much less quickly than house prices, and that's because the supply has come there. So the focus on housing really should be a focus on how do we increase the supply and make the supply side of the market more flexible. I think it's a mistake to think that we can manage this through playing around with various levers that affect demand. It's supply that needs to be the focus.
It's all about supply. So I probably won't ask, so I'll ask this question, but I won't get you to answer it. It says, looking forward to the challenge of being the next RBA governor. but I think it captures...
I think it's a good place to stop, isn't it?
It's a great place to stop the presentation. Phil, that really appreciate the candour and the questions from the audience which you tackled them. It was a great scene setting for our conference today. Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Philip Lowe.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Philip. That was great.